This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Cindy Cohn of the Electronic Frontier Foundation about the Congress's recent vote to extend mass surveillance.
They did it by affirming the existence of the FISA court, only one-sided, secret, meets in a windowless room, and rubber stamps every request almost that the government makes to surveil our citizens.
We'll talk with attorney Simone Bertolini about the first big win in a cybersecurity trial on so-called click fraud charges.
The U.S. government threw everything it could at this attorney. He came in alone, defended his client, and amazingly, he won.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In a trial that was closely watched by cybersecurity experts, Italian citizen Fabio Gasparini was charged for allegedly violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, or the CFAA. Computer experts claimed it was the first so-called click fraud trial and would test the U.S. government's ability to link individuals to complex cybercrimes. As we've covered before on Law and Disorder, the CFAA is an antiquated law, passed in 1986 before personal computers and smart devices were omnipresent in all aspects of our lives. It affords law enforcement extremely wide latitude to prosecute virtually any computer-related activity, including violations of terms of service agreements. Each offense can bring up to 20 years in prison, and when multiple counts are charged, individuals can face decades behind bars. In 2017, attorney Simone Bertolini became the first known lawyer to prevail at trial against CFAA charges. His 34-year-old client, Fabio Gasparini, was found not guilty on several felony counts of wire fraud, computer intrusion, and money laundering, for which he faced 70 years in prison. He was convicted on only one count of computer intrusion, a misdemeanor, which is currently being appealed. Attorney Bertolini disputed prosecutors' version of events and noted that none of the expert witnesses had ever seen the botnet that Gasparini allegedly used. He also questioned how he could be charged with conspiracy when no conspirators were named or charged. Joining us today to discuss this case and harsh U.S. computer laws and extranational prosecutions is attorney Simone Bertolini. Simone Bertolini, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You represented Fabio Gasparini in the first ever so-called click fraud trial. Let's start by clarifying some terminology. What is click fraud, and then what are botnets?
Most websites have advertising banners. The more clicks the banner gets, and the more money the owner of that website receives. Click fraud takes place when someone artificially inflates the number of banner clicks. That can be done manually, through a computer script, or through a botnet. A botnet is essentially a network of hacked computers. In a botnet, each computer is infected with a bot, which is a software application that performs automated tasks over the internet.
And is that short for robot, the bot?
Correct. Botnet is supposed to be short for robot and internet.
Oh, I see. How big a problem exactly is click fraud?
I don't think it's a real problem nowadays, just because big companies have developed advanced protections against click fraud in the past 10 years.
Let's talk about your client. Mr. Gasparini faced up to 70 years in prison on the federal computer-related charges. Who is Mr. Gasparini, and what were the laws that he was charged with breaking?
Like me, Gasparini was born and raised in Rome. Before he was arrested by the FBI, he used to work as a network administrator for an online betting company, also located in Rome. Gasparini was accused of violating two counts of computer intrusion under 18 U.S.C. 1030, subsection A2 and subsection A4. He was also accused of one count of wire fraud, one count of wire fraud conspiracy, and one count of money laundering conspiracy.
We've talked on this show before about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Is that in one of the laws you just mentioned?
Yes, 18 U.S.C. 1030.
Okay. Now, we know that this is a very difficult charge to prevail on. What were your general defenses in court?
Well, before trial, I mainly argued that this was an impermissible extraterritorial prosecution. At trial, I mainly argued to the jury at the end that there was no sufficient evidence to convict Gasparini.
We understand this was literally your first case in court. You had not litigated before. How did you approach this case? What research did you do? Were you frightened of facing the government on this? I understand they had quite a powerful team.
Well, I had handled several criminal defenses cases before, but none of them ever went to trial. So I had no trial experience. Yes, of course, it was frightening, thinking that I had to go to, to trial on this. I honestly thought that they were going to offer me a plea agreement before trial because we just didn't believe that all the witnesses were showing up, especially, witnesses from abroad, from all over the country. But at the end, they did decide to try the case. And yes, at the beginning, it was frightening. I mean, I didn't think I could eventually win.
And you were
there alone. Yeah. I mean, the other side had a team. You had to make all these decisions alone. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, that's correct. I basically, had to handle all the pretrial motions, all the trial preparation, all the cross-examinations of every witness by myself with Gasparini. Gasparini, of course, was of some help, at least on the technical part. The government came with two prosecutors that just specialize in this area of law. They came with two or three FBI agents. There were a lot of interns every morning in court. They came every morning with a big, actually, there were two carts with evidence and files. And, I mean, just looking at that every morning, of course, it was a little bit uncomfortable, but...
How did you meet Mr. Gasparini?
Gasparini's family found me on the internet.
Because you're Italian?
Because I'm Italian. Well, I'm from Rome like him. Basically, they were looking for someone that spoke Italian. Right. But when I asked Gasparini, why did you and your family decide to hire me? I mean, on my website, I say that I do mostly immigration work. He justified that with, sort of curious explanation. He said that he talked to other Italian lawyers in New York that do criminal law, but he didn't feel comfortable with them because they were just telling him that there was no way that he would ever beat the charges, that he had to trust them, that he had to plead guilty, and he had to start thinking about spending years in jail.
Now, that's an interesting point. And I wonder, and I think this happens, Michael, in certain cases, where an attorney's relative inexperience in a given field might actually be an advantage because you're not as...
Has been burned.
You haven't been brainwashed to thinking it's impossible for you to prevail on this. So you went in, I think, with a fresh approach, and you save the day. Now, one of the challenges that we've talked about in defending computer-related crimes, there are a couple. One is the jury's understanding or lack of understanding about technology issues. Another challenge is that clients are often given limited access to a computer before a trial to go over electronic materials to help their lawyers mount a defense. Did you encounter any of these challenges?
Well, as far as the understanding or lack of understanding by the jury, I think that it's a bigger problem for the prosecution. I thought that they did a good job on their end, trying to make everything visual and easy to understand. On my end, I just over-prepared the experts' cross-examinations. I just put all my efforts in that part. The jury obviously didn't understand the technical part of it, but the jury could see that the experts were getting nervous after long lines of questions, and especially when they had to retract prior testimony. As far as the potential problem with having the technology to review the discovery, the court ordered the government to give Gasparini a dedicated laptop. The problem here was that the government was allowed to serve additional discovery a few days before trial, and even in the middle of the trial, and I thought that that was very unfair.
What did the government say that your client did, and who was hurt by it?
Well, according to the government, Fabio Gasparini set up and operated a botnet, and the purpose of setting up and operating the botnet, according to the indictment, was to pursue a click fraud. A click fraud against an Italian company. So that's why, you know, I argued before trial that this was an impermissible extraterritorial prosecution. A few days before trial, the government served me additional discovery that related to alleged involvement of U.S.-based companies with the Italian advertising company that the government say that Gasparini was defrauding. So that's how they wanted to connect Gasparini with a trial in the United States.
So let's go back a step. If the allegations were that your client ran this click fraud operation, would he profit from it financially?
That was alleged, yes.
And you didn't know until a few days before trial that the government was alleging there was U.S. involvement in terms of a U.S. business entity.
Correct.
Okay, so that raises a question, a larger question, of how the United States government pursues alleged computer-related crimes in other countries. We have among the harshest computer-related laws, and they're very outdated. They haven't really kept up with current technology. Do you have an opinion about U.S. computer laws and how authorities do go after individuals in other nations? We've seen that a lot recently with the young hacker Marcus Hutchins, who stopped the WannaCry malware, and then when he came to DEF CON conference this last summer, was arrested by authorities. What's your opinion on how we do things?
Well, I wanted to open a parenthesis on that. I spoke to Gasparini about Hutchins, and his opinion is that he was involved with the malware. It did not stop. But of course, it's his opinion for whatever it's worth. And he actually suggested me to reach out to him to see if I could perhaps help him with the case.
Nice.
As far as the CFAA being outdated, I agree with that. I'm not sure that is the harshest computer-related law, you know, compared to other countries. For example, in Italy, simple computer intrusion is punished as a felony with a term of incarceration of up to 3 years. In the U.S., instead, it's a misdemeanor, and that's exactly what Gasparini was convicted of, and it's punishable with incarceration up to 1 year. As far as the extraterritorial application of U.S. laws, the Supreme Court made it clear U.S. laws govern domestically but do not rule the world. That, of course, does not prevent prosecutors from continuing to go after people abroad, even if their case doesn't have anything to do with the U.S. And the Gasparini's case is a prime example of that. As far as, you know, the prosecutors being harsh with hackers, my opinion is that the government wants to make an example out of each one of them, or at least the ones that they can detect, because apparently it's extremely difficult to detect hackers. Whenever they have a chance of getting one, they go very hard on them.
Was Mr. Gasparini charged in Italy?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the answer is yes and no. It's yes, because this is how the government, the U.S. government, operated in this case. They wanted to seize evidence in Gasparini's apartment, and they wanted to take a shortcut. They didn't want to go through MLAT requests, the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty requests. So what they did, they approached Italian prosecutors. They told them that, in their opinion, Gasparini was engaged in click fraud. They convinced them to file criminal charges against him just to get a warrant to seize evidence in his apartment. And after that, those Italian charges were just dropped.
So it was like a fishing expedition to get information.
Yes, and that was violative of Gasparini's Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights.
Exactly. Why do you think, since you're now involved in this, that U.S. prosecutors are so heavy-handed when it comes to hackers? You've just suggested that it's difficult for them to identify alleged hackers and to sort of, you know, put a name to some of their online handles, I would imagine. And I guess I ask that in the context of U.S. corporations and the government themselves do such an inadequate job of securing their own computer systems.
Well, I'm not sure whether they do an inadequate job. I'm not a hacker, so I wouldn't know. My understanding is that they see hackers as a big threat because hackers can hide anywhere, even in countries that are not friendly to the U.S., so they would do anything to dissuade them from doing anything.
Now, in your case, you prevailed at trial, your first trial, on the felony charges against Mr. Gasparini, but they did find him guilty on one misdemeanor charge, and you have appealed that. Can you tell us what the appeal is about?
Yes, Gasparini, as you said, was convicted of one count of simple computer intrusion that does not require intent to defraud, that does not require a commercial purpose. On appeal, I raised a number of arguments. Of course, I can't discuss all of them because that would take too much time, but the main ones are that the information obtained is not protected by the CFAA, that the government illegally seized Gasparini's email account, that this was an impermissible extraterritorial litigation, that there was no sufficient evidence to convict Gasparini, and that imposition of the maximum statutory sentence was not justified.
Simone, for listeners who may be confused, like you know, I'm not good at this, so I'm not quite clear. What did your defendant? What did they say he did, and who did he hurt by it? What was their beef against him?
The government basically accused Gasparini of setting up and operating a botnet to inflate the number of clicks to the banners that were placed on websites that he controlled. But according to the government, Gasparini was deriving revenue by getting more money from the company that he was doing business with, which is an Italian company. And that's why I argue that this was an impermissible extraterritorial litigation. However, a few days before trial, they tried to cover that up by saying that some U.S. companies were doing business with the Italian company that was paying Gasparini, so that ultimately these U.S. companies would be the victims. So what happened here is that you are a company that sells whatever product, let's say shoes. You contract with a marketing company that they will show 10,000 times your, you know, your banner on someone's website. And that someone is a website owner that runs any kind of blog and that gets visiting to his website. So when his visitors see the banner of the shoe company, they may or may not click on the banner. So now that website owner gets more money when there's more clicks into that banner because every, for example, 10,000 clicks, he gets $500. So of course, the more click he gets, the more money he gets. So the company that sells shoes will be the victim because they expect that 10,000 interested people click on their banners, and instead there's scripts and robots clicking on that.
Yeah, that's how the fraud is committed.
Correct.
Now I get
that.
It.
That says it very clearly. Thank you. And when was that filed? When's the next procedural court appearance?
There is no court appearance on the appeal yet. I filed my brief. The government is supposed to file their brief by February 15th, I believe. And then I will have 14 days from that to file a reply. I will assume that the Second Circuit will eventually schedule oral argument on this case.
There's been a lot of publicity about this particular case, and several commentators have called it landmark in terms of how complex cyber crimes are presented to juries. What do you think they meant by that?
To me, that statement doesn't mean anything. Every cyber crime case is complex. Whoever made that statement just tried to somehow justify the government defeat. Maybe the press didn't feel comfortable admitting that a younger lawyer alone was able to beat the government in such a complex and technical case. I don't see this as a landmark case.
Right.
I think Gasparini was acquitted because the government didn't have enough evidence, and that's all.
Well, we here at Law and Disorder certainly respect your tenacity and the dedicated approach that you took to this case. What were the flaws in the government's case, specifically about the existence of the botnet?
Well, the government wanted to prove their charges that Gasparini set up and operating a botnet by presenting a picture to the jury, and this picture was found in Gasparini's Google Drive account. That was, to me and apparently to the jury, insufficient to prove that he had a botnet. What I told the jury during oral argument is that he would be the equivalent of trying to prove possession of a gun in a gun possession case with a picture of the gun being found in someone's email account.
And you mentioned that some of the expert witnesses for the government actually had to recant some of their testimony. What kinds of expert witnesses were these?
Yes, the government called three computer scientists besides three local computer owners that the FBI said that had their computer hacked. The government had also called representatives from various server providers, representatives from Facebook, PayPal, and even police officers from Italy and the Netherlands. The problem with the government's case, as far as the forensic testimony, is that the lead expert made too many assumptions. Also, he admitted that when he ran the script on a test device in a laboratory, part of that click fraud script did not execute. He admitted that the same part of the script might not have executed on other devices as well.
I just want to make sure I have this accurately. The government in this case drew upon an array of experts, including individuals from other countries. Their claims in many cases were really based on insufficient evidence. And it sounds as though they brought this case with a heavy hand and probably expected they would prevail on these felony charges. You discounted a lot of the expert witnesses. You discounted some of their theories. And you really attacked them on the overbreadth of their charges.
Well, before trial, I made the arguments with the court that this case could not have been litigated in the United States. At trial, I had to take a completely different approach. One, because I don't believe you can argue the law with the jury. Second, because the jury doesn't care about the law. They want to know the facts. They want to know if a defendant did what he was accused of doing or did not. So at trial, I just put all the energy and all the efforts into breaking their experts' testimony and showing to the jury that these experts came to testify as to something that was not conclusive, that they have doubts, and that they couldn't establish with certainty, and certainly not beyond a reasonable doubt, that Gasperini was involved with the botnet and that Gasperini was involved with the click fraud scheme.
Simone, I imagine that after this success, you might be hearing from some alleged hackers or called on to represent defendants in computer-related offenses. Are you up for that task?
Yes, I will consider that for sure.
Simone, how can listeners learn more about your work and this case?
Well, I posted the entire cross-examination on of one of the government experts on my website. So if someone is interested, can go to my website. They can just go on Google and search because it's too long, the website.
So okay. What should they Google? Your name?
Your name.
They should Google Fabio Gasperini trial, Fabio Gasperini's cross-examination, something like that. It should show up on first page. There are links on my website, so it's just, they can go to my website. It's simoneberolini.com. And also, I posted links to those documents on my Twitter account, on my LinkedIn account.
Great. And let's just put this out there for other individuals who may be charged with computer offenses. In our studio, we have a truly successful attorney.
We have a winner.
A winner.
Thank you.
Simone Bertolini, it's been really fascinating to have you on, and we wish you the best of luck in your continued cases.
Thank you very much.
You're a very good attorney in four languages.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
U.S. Congress voted to pass a bill extending for another 6 years the National Security Agency's practice of unwarranted internet surveillance. Cindy Cohn, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, called this, quote, a significant blow against the basic human right to read, write, learn, and associate free of government's prying eyes. The vote happened without public debate on a matter of significant public concern. The legislation in question, allowing warrantless surveillance, is Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Amendments Act. The act is intended to target foreigners abroad. In practice, it submits a great deal of our own internet activities to government scrutiny as they pass through key internet checkpoints and as they are stored by providers such as Google and Facebook. The NSA is thus able to gather and store private communications of countless non-suspect Americans. We are delighted to welcome Cindy Cohn from the Electronic Frontier Foundation back to Law and Disorder to talk about this extension of warrantless spying and what it means for all of us. Cindy Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Cindy, remind our listeners why privacy in our electronic communications is so important.
Well, it matters for a couple of reasons. One is nobody really likes somebody looking over your shoulder and watching everything you do. We know from scientific studies that that makes people actually behave differently if you're being watched all the time. I think it's also important from the perspective of the First Amendment and freedom of expression, the ability to communicate with other people and organize and make change in our world really does depend on people having a space where the government or your political opponents aren't always watching you. It also matters, I think, especially for people who are going through periods of self-discovery when you're trying to decide, you know, what kind of person you want to be in the world. Adolescents definitely need a zone of privacy, But then it can also help people in a very much more dangerous situation, say trying to get out from under abuse or harassment. These are all situations in which, you know, basic human privacy and communications becomes important all the way up to life-saving.
And it really stands democracy on its head, doesn't it? Democracy is supposed to be a government by the people, but here you have the government looking at the people. That's what's so creepy to me about it.
I think that's right. And, you know, one of the things that's difficult for, I think, folks to understand is how surveillance can really work at scale. The kinds of tools that are, you know, used by Google to try to predict whether you're going to buy shoes or not, or other kinds of things. The kind of mass surveillance tools that are deployed both in the commercial sector, but more importantly by the government, are really very, very efficient at figuring out who's talking about topics that they might want to pay attention to. They don't have to have a human being listening to every conversation. So if people say, well, you know, I'm not that interesting, why would anybody listen to me? And I think that that misunderstands how this actually works, because there isn't somebody listening to you waiting for you to say something interesting. When you say something interesting, then they're able to go to listen to you and even go back in time and figure out what you've said before. That's a fundamental change in our relationship to our government.
Cindy, what was the state of affairs before 702 of the FISA Amendment Act was added? Did it really mean this kind of spying wasn't going on, or just that it was completely uncontrolled in a way?
Well, so there's a couple time periods. So before the Patriot Act of September 11th actually changes, this kind of mass spying was actually something that the NSA was doing overseas. There were big listening posts in various places overseas. They were not as sophisticated. You know, technology's gotten better, but this kind of watch everything that travels over the communications infrastructure was something that the NSA deployed overseas under an authority called 12333. After September 11th, the government pushed to do that same kind of mass spying domestically. And from, you know, around 2001 through 2008, when the FISA Amendments Act passed, the government was doing this mass surveillance, but was essentially doing it under an executive claim of executive authority. So the Bush administration, as you might recall, thought that the president could do whatever the president wanted without having to check in with Congress or the American people. This is one of the things that the government started doing. By 2006, 2007, there were serious concerns being raised both inside the administration and the FISA courts and in our cases that were outside in the public courts. And there was pressure on the government to begin to bring this authority under, you know, the rule of law a little bit anyway. And so they secretly passed Section 702. It doesn't say anything about mass spying in Section 702, but to the people inside the Beltway or the, you know, inside the intelligence community, this was wink, wink, nudge, nudge, the way that they could say now that what they were doing was legal. It wasn't until the Snowden revelations in 2013 that the rest of us started realizing that this was what they thought they were legalizing with Section 702, because they actually said it was about something quite different. So there's a kind of a long history here, but this kind of mass spying is newly revealed to the American people to be something that is including them. That's for sure. And the government has tried all sorts of sleight of hand and legal tricks and, as I said, kind of passing laws that seem to be doing one thing but are actually doing another along the way. It's one of the reasons why Mr. Snowden's revelations were so important, because people like me and our colleagues in the privacy community had long suspected that this was something that was being done, but it wasn't until his revelations that we were able to kind of put the pieces together and see how the government had decided for itself in secret that it was okay to do.
Cindy, was this recent extension of the FISA provision inevitable? And if not, were there other compromise bills, such as the USA Rights Act?
Yeah, oh, there were plenty. There were bipartisan compromise bills. There was a lot more movement towards trying to scale this back, especially in the pieces of it that impact ordinary Americans in their communication. You know, we're not comfortable with the idea that the NSA thinks it can spy on all the rest of the world with impunity either. But the piece in D.C. that people really thought they had traction on was this question of when they have collected all this data, when do they get to search through it for Americans who might be suspected of a regular old crime? You know, we know that the government has used this big data case to look into people who were accused of, spousal abuse or child abuse. I mean, you know, all sorts of crimes, which are serious crimes, but really aren't the kind of national security terrorism excuse that we hear a lot. For the government. So there was a real effort both in the Senate and in the House to try to scale back some of the uses of this data, if not the actual scope of collection. And they were doing pretty well. Honestly, we had a pretty good head count on it, but ultimately the leadership in the House and the Senate used a bunch of, you know, frankly, procedural tricks to make sure that there were never any real hearings, there was never any public debate, and they rushed this thing through so that, you know, groups like us and the members of Congress who were trying to raise concerns couldn't really get any traction to try to draw attention to the thing. And so it was rushed through, frankly, with a lot of sleight of hand by the government, you know, calling, you know, the massive collection of Americans' communications, incidental collection, for instance, is the kind of, you know, really, I think, misleading framing that we saw by the government all the way through. So I feel like we really didn't get a chance to have a fair hearing in front of the American people about whether this was what they wanted or not. And it's really unfortunate because these are important and big questions, and the American people deserve to have a voice.
What about the certain Democrats? Weren't there a lot of Democrats that went along with this and voted for it?
There sure were. You know, the intelligence community is, you know, supported by people on both sides of the aisle in some, you know, confusing ways. You know, there, you know, Nancy Pelosi, for instance, and several other people, Dianne Feinstein, although she fainted in one direction and voted for this thing to go forward. People who have raised concerns about the abuses of our current government and the Trump administration and the danger of putting and the misuse of executive power that we're seeing from the presidency, some of those very people then voted to continue with this very powerful, very secret, very frightening program. And I find it really troubling. You know, on the one hand, they're sounding the alarm about the excesses of this administration, and on the other hand, they're voting to give it, you know, to continue this very broad, unaccountable power.
Cindy, how does this development impact others around the globe? Is there opposition among other governments, say, in the European Union? And do you think it emboldens others elsewhere to spy on their own people?
Yeah, I think it emboldens people, governments around the world, not only to spy on their own people, but to spy on us too, right? I mean, we've really got a race to the bottom now. For governments, the United States government basically saying it can spy on everybody. I don't think there's any argument that we could make that, say, the Chinese government shouldn't be spying on us, or any government in the world, the German government shouldn't be spying on all of us with impunity. And I think that's really troubling. There are some interesting activities in Europe around something called the Privacy Shield, which is an effort to try to the European privacy regulators to try to create some kind of framework for American companies who are gathering up lots of data about Europeans to have to hold to some kind of standard, and whether the NSA's kind of broad access to those communications is consistent with EU privacy law. I think we're going to see more, I hope we're going to see more activity in that area in the future, because the European authorities are very concerned about privacy, both in the commercial side, a little less so in the government side, but there's some space there. I think it's really inconsistent. It needs to be consistent across the board. We need to have privacy regardless of who's trying to spy on us, whether it's companies or governments. This is one area where I think the European Union authorities are a little further ahead of most of the governments of both the EU and the United States on this. And so Hopefully there'll be more coming out of there. I think it's a very good place. You know, people, the right to privacy isn't just something we talk about in the United States. It's an actually international human right. It's one of the core values of the democratic institutions around the world. And, I don't think that most of the rest of the world thinks it's okay for the U.S. government to exempt itself from protecting people's privacy around the world.
Cindy, the FISA court isn't really a court in the normal sense of how we understand a court, is it? And I wonder whether you could talk about who's on it, how do you get on it, where is it located, are there both sides to an argument when somebody appears in front of the court? Talk about how abnormal the FISA court is.
Yeah, people use the word court, and to a certain extent it is actually made up by regular district court judges. Are hand-selected by the Chief Justice, John Roberts, to also serve on this other secret court. But it's not like a court that people are normally useful because there's only one side. The government comes in front of these judges and asks for the authority to spy on people. And so it's not really, it's much more like an administrative process than it is like a judicial one, because I think the hallmark of a judicial process is there are two sides and the judge is deciding. And that's a criticism that's been leveled by some of the former judges themselves, that they really don't have the resources necessary or another side to present the other side of things. Now, one of the things that we were able to get out of a law a couple of years ago was to give the judges the opportunity to appoint somebody to help them and to kind of play the other side. But that's fine. It's a good thing, but it's a poor substitute for a real, adversarial process. There's lots of criticisms as well that, Chief Justice John Roberts is not picking judges in order to have a balanced court, but instead the judges who have made it on the court tend to be overwhelmingly pretty conservative. There's also an interesting geographical thing. They tend to all be actually near the court. It sits in Washington, D.C., so judges in, say, the Ninth Circuit out here in California or some of the districts in the middle of the country are pretty rarely chosen to have this, whereas the judges in the courts in the East Coast tend to get chosen more often. So it slants pretty conservative because of Robert's selection, and it's only one-sided, and they don't really have the resources or ability to cross-examine the government in a serious way about its presentation. So all of that is troubling, and for years the FISA court was really only approving surveillance over agents of a foreign government. So this was where the government would go to, say, get a warrant to spy on spies, foreign spies. So, while this process isn't the best, if it was limited to situations like in the Americans TV show, right, where we've got foreign agents in the United States and they want to get a warrant to spy on them for intelligence purposes, not for criminal prosecutions, it's not the best process, but it's not so bad. But over the years, its role has been expanded, and now it's passing on mass surveillance that obviously and clearly includes millions of Americans. And our rights shouldn't be decided in this truncated way. And with regard to the mass surveillance, the secret court doesn't approve individual surveillance. It doesn't say, we think this person might be engaged in terrorism. It already did that. The mass surveillance, it kind of just approves a program. Here's what our mass surveillance is going to look like. They say, okay, and then they go ahead with the mass surveillance. But that's not actually the kind of approval that the Constitution requires before the government can surveil you.
It's kind of like blanket approval.
Exactly. And it's very troubling. And even if you look at the, lots of these courts apparently, because of good work and under the Freedom of Information Act by the EFF and other organizations, we've unearthed some of these. We've gotten the court to have to cough up some of these opinions. And you see, even in this truncated, kind of one-sided situation, the government is always messing up. They're never, they're always out of compliance. So even the FISA court judges have expressed serious frustration with the government's inability to really follow even its own rules on this. So, from my perspective, when a secret one-sided court still thinks you're not doing it right, and that it's, you know, that it's not possible. It may mean that mass surveillance is really hard to do in general and impossible to do in a way that also protects people's rights enough.
Well, speaking of impossibility, Cindy, is this extension irreversible for now, or are there steps we can take to see it rescinded?
Well, any law can be rescinded by another law. It's a six-year extension of the authority, and so in 6 years it'll come up again. Those are important moments, but, you know, it's hard to do that. There are lots of things that we can do in the meantime, though, to try to scale it back, and there's certainly, you know, I don't think Senator Wyden and some of the other senators who are strongly on our side, including Senator Paul, are going to give up and not try to scale this back in some other ways along the way. But the whole program isn't up again until for 6 years. Now, again, at any time, if there's enough interest in Congress, they can just pass another law to change this, and we'd certainly be in favor of that. You know, we're continuing our cases in the courts, though. They're also been on a very, very slow train. It's very hard to do national security litigation. The courts are very nervous about the secrecy issues. But we are inching our way towards getting a decision on Section 702 out here in our big case called Jewell versus NSA in California. There's a case in the Fourth Circuit that the ACLU has as well, and a couple other ones floating around. So, you know, ultimately, I believe this is a constitutional question, and that the courts ought to be the place, the open adversarial courts ought to be the place where we decide, you know, how does the Fourth Amendment apply to us in this time when mass surveillance is possible? So we'll continue to work in the courts. We'll continue to try to work in public opinion, and we continue to develop technologies to try to deploy encryption in our communications and other security methods to make the government's mass surveillance not quite so invasive on people's lives, to give people the ability to put an envelope over their communications instead of having to always write on postcards, so that they can at least get a measure of protection for their communications on their own.
Nicely said, Cindy, because I was just going to ask you for a wrap-up on EFF's work, and I want to remind listeners that your website, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is really the go-to site for a wonderful roundup of not only your litigation, but your advocacy efforts on behalf of technology, privacy, and surveillance matters. Can you remind us what that website is?
Sure, it's EFF.org.
And we're glad to hear that Jewell v. NSA is still alive and kicking.
Yeah, not dead yet. You know, they keep trying, but they've just recently tried. They're under an order from the court to provide information to the judge in secret about the scope of who's included in the mass surveillance. And they keep trying to kick that date out, and they tried to make it, they tried in October to get the judge to just give them no deadline whatsoever, and the judge said no. They set the original deadline for late January. The government asked for 2 more weeks, but by mid-February, they're supposed to have delivered this information to Judge White out here in California, and then we'll see where we go. I suspect that they're going to claim secrecy, and we may have to go up all the way to the Supreme Court on the question of the secrecy here before we get to the merits. But, you know, we're in this for the long run. It takes a long time. The national security infrastructure of the United States is very, very powerful. And, you know, you have to be in it for the long run if you're going to get these kinds of things scaled back. But, you know, we are. We want to do this. We believe in an internet where you can have a private conversation without having to worry that the government's listening. It's a very simple proposition. People deserve the right to have a private conversation online. And we're going to keep working until we've made that happen.
And, Cindy, for that, you are our heroes. We really love the work that you do.
Thank you.
Take care, Cindy. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER-FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio,
Your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYRLP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online. We welcome two new stations that are carrying Law and Disorder Radio, KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.